Hello, it's Wednesday 25th of June. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
Today, we're dedicating the whole show to travel and tourism in Malaysia, the country in which we both live.
Yeah, there's plenty of trials and tribulations and a few controversies to discuss along the way. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, before we begin, Gary, you resumed your post-pandemic travels this week, didn't you? So tell us about it. Where did you go?
I went to Penang. I took a flight from Subang Airport here in KL, flew up to Penang and stayed in Georgetown. The first trip, Georgetown was the last destination that I traveled to before the pandemic, and it was the first one post-pandemic. Nice. The trip because I used to live there. I spent a year living there in 2014, 2015, so it's a place that's close to my heart.
Yeah.
So it's nice to go back and see what was happening up there. We'll discuss domestic tourism a little bit later in the show, but it was very, very quiet. There aren't many tourists there at the moment. The situation is that the airports are very quiet too. There aren't many flights to and fro. I expected there would be more, but I guess we just have to give it time to rebuild some demand in the travel sector. But visiting Penang is always a pleasure. The weather was great. It was beautifully hot. The food was great.
Of course.
Everybody was very welcoming. So it was a nice trip just for a couple of days.
Yeah. Good.
And what about you, Hannah? What have you been up to this week?
I mean, I've been very much in KL. We were saying earlier, weren't we, that it's been an unremarkable time during a remarkable time.
That's true.
That probably sums up my week. Pretty unremarkable so far. Just a bit of client work, bit of research here and there. Yeah, getting through the week, basically.
Yeah, that's very much the case at the moment. As you say, an unremarkable time in a remarkable time.
Yes.
Yeah, it sums it up very nicely. Okay, so Hannah, on today's show, it's all about Malaysia. And let's begin, as we usually do, by taking stock of the statistical situation. So over to you.
Okay, right. Well, in Malaysia in 2019, it officially welcomed 26.1 million arrivals. If you look at those figures month on month, July was actually the top month for visitors last year, followed by June and August. So if this were a normal year, we'd be very much in the middle of peak season right now.
Yeah, we would. But if you look at the arrivals figures historically, not a great deal has changed over the last decade, really.
It hasn't.
Which is rather disappointing given the growth rates we've seen in other Southeast Asian countries during that same period.
Yeah.
So 26.1 million arrivals in 2019 compares pretty similarly to 25.7 million in 2015 and represents a fairly meager rise from 24.6 million back in 2010.
Yeah.
This year, 2020, which was to be dedicated as Visit Malaysia Year, a target was set of 30 million arrivals, 30 million, which, when you compare the data in recent years, always looked a little bit ambitious.
It did, didn't it? If we dig into the 2019 arrivals figures for Malaysia, the top five inbound markets were all Asian countries. So Singapore was first, which was a massive 10.2 million arrivals. But it was actually down 4.3% year on year. Indonesia came in second with 3.6 million. China was third with 3.1 million. Thailand fourth with 1.9 million and Brunei fifth with 1.2 million. You know, so that's the landscape in terms of key inbound markets, but we drill down a little bit further and actually only 36.8% of visitors to Malaysia in 2019 arrived by air. Actually, 4.9% arrived by sea, but a massive 56.8% arrived by land. So I can imagine that that is driven a lot by Singaporeans crossing over into Malaysia.
Yep.
You know, Indonesians crossing over into Sarawak, into Sabah, Brunei, maybe even southern Thailand. Actually, quite a big percentage, isn't it?
That's a really, really high figure. Yeah, really is. I mean, there are, as you said, borders with four countries. But I think it also really represents just how important the Singapore overland market is in terms of visitor numbers. We've discussed this before on the board, haven't we, Anne? Not often is that always about tourism. You know, there's a lot of visiting family and friends, a lot of Singaporeans own houses, particularly in southern Malaysia.
Yeah.
So there are a number of reasons that Singaporeans do come to Malaysia, and tourism is definitely one of those.
Yeah.
But
it is, and I'm sure that we'll talk about this a little bit later, but in terms of that border crossing, you know, there's a lot of talk, hasn't there, over the past couple of weeks from ministers in Singapore and in Malaysia, both saying we need to get this border open, but I think one of the Singaporean minister or Malaysian minister, I can't remember who, but they said it's one of the busiest land borders in the world.
Yeah.
So whatever you do in terms of, you know, strict health protocols and everything else, it's got to be spot on, else it's going to cause a heck of a traffic jam.
Absolutely. And we keep seeing these pictures of that Causeway Bridge just empty. You see them a lot, these overhead views. As you said, it's a very, very busy border throughout the year, throughout the day and then the weekend as well.
Yeah.
But it's currently empty and you do see these images quite frequently. So that's the situation it was at the end of 2019. And 2020 was all set up to be Visit Malaysia Year, as we just discussed. Mm-hmm. So can you give us some background, Hannah? What was Visit Malaysia Year supposed to be? You know, what were the goals, the objectives, and what's happened to it?
Well, Visit Malaysia, it really follows a long line of other promotions that they've done. So they've held this in 1990, in 1994, in 2007, in 2014, where they hit their highest target of, well, not the target, but they hit their highest arrival numbers, 27.44 million. And the whole idea behind it is just to generate more international tourists. So they rally everybody around this, including the airlines, the tour operators, their local kind of supporting travel agencies overseas as well. And they had big plans, didn't they? So they wanted to get 30 million tourists this year. They wanted to get 100 billion ringgit in revenue.
And they've been planning for quite a while. I mean, we had this issue going back. When was that? There was the logo issue.
Oh, yeah. So I was looking at the dates for that. And this logo issue actually came up beginning of 2018.
Okay.
So two years ago. And this whole, I mean, I'm not sure how much our listeners have followed this, but basically the Malaysian government unveiled this logo that people were calling it an abomination. Yeah, the image itself wasn't controversial. It was just controversial in that it was so basic. It looked like maybe a child had developed it, or they had just tasked some staff somewhere to develop it. It had like these orangutans with sunglasses on. Yeah. It was like some kind of stamp. And everybody was just like, what is this? This doesn't represent Malaysia.
They had to backtrack pretty quickly. Yeah,
they did. So they soon removed that. And then actually it took them a year and a half to come out with the new one. They ran a competition, I guess, to make it seem fairer. And eventually it was launched in July of 2019 by the new government also, because they changed governments, I think, between then. They launched it with this new logo, which was, I think, a hornbill, and it's batik, and much more Malaysian. So people were marginally happier with that. Yeah. But you know what online people are still like. Yeah. They still argued that other ones were better, because they had all of the options online, didn't they, and things. But it just created this whole controversy in Malaysia, actually. That probably raised up more interest about Visit Malaysia than the actual campaign did.
Yeah, because it was a long run-up, as you said. Yeah. I mean, that logo goes back to 2018.
Yeah.
The trade shows ever since, in the media. Yeah. There's particularly towards the end of 2019, there was huge national promotion of this national tourism promotion campaign.
Yeah.
And even into the beginning part of 2020, it was still going. The government had actually made some visa waivers for Indian and for Chinese visitors this year to try and boost the numbers. Yeah. And then obviously COVID-19 struck towards the end of January.
Yeah, so I mean, they still hung on. I was looking back this morning and I still even saw news articles from February saying, we're not going to change our arrival number targets. We're still, Visit Malaysia Year is still on. And then, of course, they decided to implement lockdown, and very quickly they announced the cancellation of Visit Malaysia Year 2020.
Yeah, which the problem for that for the country is that so much resources, so much time and effort, and so many actual promotional campaigns and discounts and vouchers and coupons were actually dedicated to run throughout the year.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they had to press this reset button.
Yeah, they had to you know, even the airlines had it all on their livery. They put all these Visit Malaysia stickers on the livery. Cars had got it. So, yeah, it was a complete screech to a halt.
Yeah.
Really. Though.
So as you said there, Hannah, lockdown was implemented here, I think it was on the 18th of March in Malaysia. And the whole campaign was cancelled, I think, about a week later.
Yeah, I think it was about that, yes.
It just wasn't going to be possible from that point.
No, they realised that it just had to stop, basically.
Yeah. And as we stand right now, we're towards the end of June, halfway through the year. Currently, international travel is not permitted into the country, although that some regulations are being slightly lifted, but
It's still not really for tourists.
It's returnees, and there was some talk this week that healthcare travelers from particularly from Indonesia, because that's such a big market, might be able to come in the coming weeks or months. Mm. But the health minister did say this week that the overall objective is to drive down COVID-19 cases to zero by the middle of July. And if that's the objective, then you can't see that international travel is going to be introduced before then, because it wouldn't make any sense at all.
No, I mean, I wonder if they're going for this kind of coveted 30-day COVID-free kind of status that a lot of other countries are kind of touting. You know, you look at Vietnam. Vietnam was saying, oh, we're only going to open up to countries who have, you know, this kind of 30 days COVID-free, you know, or at least free of local transmission. Maybe they're trying to go for that.
And it often goes overlooked in the international media, particularly just how successful Malaysia has been at suppressing the virus curve. I think when it entered lockdown in middle of March, I think it had the third highest number of cases in Asia, I believe, after China and Japan.
Yes.
And it gradually fell down those rankings. And it's managed to really, really suppress the curve. It's mostly community transmission is pretty low right now.
Yes.
The cases and the death numbers throughout the country are very, very low.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get the recognition for doing that. I think because the numbers, when you just look at the numbers compared to Vietnam or Cambodia, they look a little bit higher.
Yes.
And that's because the country was starting lockdown from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think they've done a really good job and people are not really talking about it. I think they took the decision to go into lockdown quite early on once they realized that they had, the government had made this mistake in allowing this, you know, because the whole thing was it was triggered by this big religious gathering. Yeah. There were how many people? Close to 20,000 people
there. Somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000.
Yeah. So that was what really triggered this explosion of cases in Malaysia.
Yeah.
But they still took that decision to lock down really early. And I think, although it was perhaps a bit of a controversial, actually, I wouldn't even say it was a controversial decision. I think a lot of Malaysians just kind of accepted it.
I think at that point, because of that gathering and the rising number of cases at that time, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I think also what often goes overlooked is actually because of that tabloid gathering, it really raised the alert for tracing and testing and tracking, which was done to some high level, actually.
Yeah.
They managed to trace pretty much all of those people at the same time as locking down.
Yeah.
So 3 months later, that does look as though they actually got that process right. Obviously now the process of reopening is extremely difficult and it's fraught with many, many difficulties, both for domestic tourism and international tourism, as we'll come to.
Yeah, so we're in this recovery movement control order, aren't we? RMCO. Yeah. So we've had MCO and then it was CMCO and now it's RMCO. Yeah.
Which when we've talked about this beforehand, how some countries have used sort of euphemisms for lockdown to try and make it sound a little bit
nicer.
But movement control order isn't really a euphemism. Right, that's pretty strict. That tells you what it was. And it was very strict. It was strictly enforced here. I mean, in the area where I live, you know, we had police every day with loud hailers telling people to stay at home. The army was brought in. There were checkpoints on highways to make sure people were adhering to these rules. They arrested a lot of people for flouting the rules. You're really only supposed to go out once a week to go to the supermarket, only one person per household.
Yeah.
And the standard operating procedures have been, I think, very well managed.
Mm-hmm.
To go into malls, to go into any public building. There are QR codes everywhere. I noticed this in Penang this week. Everybody is adhering to the rules. And that is great. You know, there is obviously a fear of the virus, and it helps that to undertake these operating procedures does enable restaurants and bars and hotels to reopen.
Yeah.
That was the trade-off for doing so. But so far, it seems to me that is holding.
Yeah, I think so. And we're seeing the numbers are now in single digits the past couple of days. So that's great. Yeah. So hopefully that's well on the way to the health minister's goal of zero.
But as we said, there are some problems. And because Visit Malaysia campaign was dedicated almost exclusively to international tourism, I mean, Malaysia does have a strong domestic tourism market.
Yeah.
Particularly because of the low-cost airlines, AirAsia, and Malindo, Fireflies. These have really helped boost domestic tourism in recent years. But at the same token, they've also helped boost regional tourism as well.
Yeah.
But the focus now is definitely on domestic tourism for the foreseeable future. You know, even though international travel may be allowed in the third quarter, maybe even the fourth quarter, I don't think anybody's expecting a surge of arrivals this year.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was quite interesting because I saw last year, actually, when they launched the Visit Malaysia campaign, Mahathir actually said, oh, we should also put some focus on domestic travel. And he said, you know, last year there were 78.2 million domestic tourists. But it was just kind of lip service, I think, wasn't it? I think they said, oh, maybe we should focus on domestic, but that was never the focus of Visit Malaysia.
But Malaysia's not alone in that. I mean, we see that across Asia. Most countries of Asia tend to see domestic travel as certainly behind inbound travel. Yeah. There are some exceptions, I think, certainly China for sure. Thailand was making some moves last year to promote it. Korea, Japan have been quite strong on domestic tourism. But in Southeast Asia, because there is this intensity of competition between each nation to attract more travelers from each other's countries and also from around Asia. You know, inbound travel has been the goal. It's where the marketing resources have been spent, the campaigns are promoted. Yeah. But domestic tourism does still happen at an increasing rate. This is something we said on the pod last week, Hannah. You know, a lot of these domestic flights that you see in countries, they handle both domestic passengers and international passengers as well. So there is this overlap, which right now we don't have.
No.
And you can see that in the demand figure.
You can. What's interesting about Malaysia, I think when we think about domestic tourism, is that, and this is something that Mata actually was saying last week in an attempt to try to get the government to reopen, is that Malaysia doesn't have such a big population as some of these other Southeast Asian countries.
Yep.
So Malaysia only has 31.5 million people. And you compare that to Thailand. Thailand's got 69 million. Vietnam has 95.5. Indonesia has 268 million. You know, that makes Malaysia's 31.5 quite small. And so there is a limit to how much they can, you know, generate from domestic tourism.
Yeah, and I think the other angle to this as well is that, you know, Malaysians do travel and they do like to travel in their own country, but also their spending priorities are different to international travelers. So it's not, you often see there isn't the spending power, which is not necessarily true.
Mm.
It's just that they tend to channel their spending into different areas. For example, you know, if you're traveling, a lot of people travel from KL up to Penang or up to towns and cities in the northern area, but they will stay with family because they have family living there. So they don't necessarily spend the money on hotels all the time. You know, they like to go out and eat. So the restaurant and the cafe scenes are boosted. At the moment, I think we're seeing a lot more of self-drive travel. So that's taking money away from the airlines.
Yes.
So the priorities are shifting and the country is going to have to find out how it balances the spend of domestic travel. And I think there's going to have to be, I think the government has said this week, there has to be some sort of incentive scheme to get people spending in certain areas of the economy. Which brings us, as I was mentioning there, that the government has to intervene into the economy. And it's tried to do that throughout lockdown.
It has.
As all governments have in the region, it's announced some stimulus measures, Hannah. But how are they actually impacting or helping the tourism sector?
Yeah, I mean, when we look right at the beginning before this all hit, so this is 27th of February, and I think you also have to remember this was a different government.
True.
Because, of course, it changed. But at that time, they announced this domestic travel stimulus, because this was a time when they still thought domestic travel was possible, they still hadn't locked down. And so they were going to do things like 100 ringgit digital vouchers, and they were going to do cut rental for airline tenants and so on. But that really kind of disappeared, these ideas, I guess, because the government changed.
Yeah.
And so new initiatives that this government have been doing mainly fall around wage subsidies and tax cuts. So for wage subsidies, they were giving things like 600 ringgit for 3 months to companies who've had a drop of 50% in business since the 1st of January. They were doing some kind of rental reductions for landlords. Then they introduced a slightly higher wage subsidy that would cover up to 1,200 ringgit per employee. That's now been extended but gone back down to 600. So if you are a travel agency or a hotel, the bulk of your cost revolves around headcount. right? It's the people, that's what costs the money. And at this point, the government is just not providing enough for these companies to be able to sustain that. So now we're seeing a lot of employees put on unpaid leave, taking substantial wage cuts. I spoke to a travel agency this week and they said that they're on unpaid leave until December. So
my goodness.
It's you know, companies are just doing everything that they can to survive. Yeah. They're essentially kind of in hibernation right now.
Yeah.
The government has introduced this new income tax relief of 1,000 ringgit for tourism expenses.
Yeah.
Though I don't think they have really clarified exactly how or what would qualify for that. And certainly, I know that MATA, the Tourism Association here, were saying, well, why don't you make it so that you can only get that 1,000 ringgit if you book via it, you know, an accredited travel agency?
Yeah.
Which seemed like a good idea to me as a way of supporting the industry, and that, of course, then supports the hotels and everything else. But nothing has really come out of that.
Yeah.
So the industry is really struggling.
Yeah, and it's an important sector for the economy. I think tourism overall is the third largest contributor to foreign exchange earnings in Malaysia after manufacturing and commodities.
Yes.
And in the hospitality industry alone, that employs 56,000 people in Malaysia.
Wow.
And even conservative estimates, which were about a month ago in the middle of May, were that maybe there would be between 10,000 and 15,000 job losses.
Yeah.
The hotel that I stayed in Penang this week, you know, they have really slimmed down their staff.
Mm.
The general manager is doing check-in. Wow. You know, this is just an example of the measures that need to be taken just to keep businesses alive.
Yeah, I mean, they even released unemployment stats, and that was just for Q1 here. And they broke it down by sector. It's not necessarily unemployment stats, but by SOCSO, so people who are still receiving these kind of benefits. And it was something like one in three of the people in KL and Selangor, so the region surrounding Kuala Lumpur, were hospitality workers.
Right.
You look at Sabah, I think it was almost 50% of workers who were receiving these unemployment benefits are in hospitality industry.
Yeah.
And that was in that was by the end of March, so you could imagine by the end of June, it's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah. The official unemployment rate in Malaysia hit 5%, which I think was a three-decade high in April of this year. Economists are projecting that could reach up to about 7% by the end of this year. That figure is contingent on the economy growing again. And we have no idea what's going to happen in Q3 and Q4. But at the moment, you know, from my experiences this week and from talking to agents and from talking to people in the industry, you know, the demand level for domestic tourism at the moment hasn't picked up yet.
Yeah,
we're only 2 weeks in. It's only 2 weeks since the curbs were lifted on traveling domestically. So it takes time for this to happen.
Absolutely.
But as we were saying, Hannah, you know, some of these businesses, the airlines, the hotels, the travel agents, they don't have that much time to wait. They're burning through cash.
Yeah.
One of the bellwethers will really be what happens with Malaysian Airlines and AirAsia.
Yeah.
We're still waiting to see, you know, what their plans are going to be going forward. If you take an example of Qantas in Australia today, they've announced a 3-year turnaround plan only based on COVID-19. So even for the next year, they're going to ground 100 of their planes. They're going to make 6,000 people redundant.
Wow.
They're going to put 15,000 of their employees on no paid leave, probably until the rest of this year. But I thought the interesting fact, you know, the CEO said they are definitely going to be a slimmed down airline in future.
Mm.
But they believe that it will take 3 years to get that business up and running again. We're going to need similar announcements from Malaysia Airlines and AirAsia, I would expect, to see how they foresee this recovery taking shape.
Yeah, you're right. And I think what's perhaps holding them back is still it's an unclear government kind of directive on what's going to happen with borders, whereas I think Australia is being a little bit clearer and saying, look, guys, we're probably not going to open this year. That's what they've said, right? It's unlikely international borders will open. But Malaysia, they've not really done that. And until the airlines get more certainty, like we were saying last week, it's very tough to make strategic decisions like that.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly here in Southeast Asia, you know, there's a lot of talk of alliances and bubbles and green lanes between different countries, but these do require reciprocity. They need each country to agree that whatever terms you allow inbound is going to be equalized for your outbound travelers to that country.
Yes.
And I think that's quite difficult to get at them. I think that's why we're seeing so many delays here.
Yeah.
And countries are also obviously very protective of how they've managed this virus. Malaysia is a very good example of that, as we said earlier, and it has managed the virus very, very well. It can't take risks on its own public health.
No, they came out last week, didn't they? And they said that, Malaysia did, that we are prepared to allow Bruneian and Singaporean citizens into Malaysia with no quarantine. But, like you said, it depends on it being reciprocal.
Yeah.
And so we're just really waiting now for what Singapore and Brunei would decide, because it seems to be that the onus is on them now. Malaysia has made that overture to them and say, you know, you would be welcome. Let's see what's going to happen.
Yeah. So looking ahead from here, Hannah, I mean, you know, what's going to happen? I mean, there were a couple of sort of big infrastructure development plans that were in place in this country. You know, we have the Penang Master Plan. So the island of Penang in the north of the country had this master plan to build new infrastructure, new railways, an LRT line, a tram system, an underwater tunnel to the mainland. It's also doing a lot of land reclamation. So in the south, they're reclaiming, well, they're building three man-made islands.
Yeah.
They're also making a new man-made island off of Gurney Drive, which is near the UNESCO World Heritage Center of Georgetown, to try and, because they're constrained for land. You know, Penang is heavily built upon.
Yes.
And Penang does have this idea that it can create a sort of Singapore-style tourism economy because it is an island away from the mainland. It's very controversial. These master plans go through several revisions, but the land reclamation works are actually happening. But at the moment, given the economic circumstances, it's pretty unsure how that will actually transpire.
Yeah.
If you look at Malacca, there's the Malacca Gateway Project, which in the city of Malacca, which is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
That's further in the south of the country. Now, a lot of this is funded by Chinese money, and a lot of the work is being done by Chinese construction companies as part of the Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative in this region. But that project, again, there's a lot of land reclamation there. They're looking to build a cruise port, a sort of mini tourism city, the Malacca Eye, which is a version of the Ferris wheel. But that's stalled at the moment. That's stalled during the pandemic. From what I understand, that the reclamation works have begun. But initially, this was supposed to open in 2025. That's certainly not going to happen.
No.
And whether the funding will come through to develop that.
Yeah.
So there's that side. And then there's the Desaru Coast down in the southeast of the country.
Yeah, so that's just next to Singapore.
And Johor.
So they've developed that, haven't they? They've opened up lots of five-star hotels. They've got the Westin is there.
Hard Rock.
There's whole kind of tourism hub, presumably to attract Singaporeans. I think there's also a lot of Chinese investment in that as well. But some of these hotels only launched, I think, perhaps the end of last year or maybe even the beginning of this year. So that's got to be a tough situation for them.
So there will need to be a lot more promotion to get that going. I mean, when Desaru, the concept, I mean, it has been quite heavily marketed in Malaysia and in Singapore as well. But at the moment, there's just not enough there. There are a couple of hotels. There's a water park.
Yeah.
There's some water activities. But, you know, it needs to be joined up a bit more. There's just not enough there yet.
I think so.
But it is a beautiful area. You know, the beaches look great. There's a lot of nature down there. But it does come down to how they actually integrate this with other opportunities for travellers. Or otherwise, you're just going to get short-stay weekend breaks. And then I think there was a plan to sort of develop the MICE market down there, you know, particularly for incentives and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But, you know, that at the moment is up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, MICE is not coming back, like we keep saying, anytime soon, we think. So
we don't think so. Although Malaysia has said that from July, gatherings of up to 250 people will be permitted.
Yeah.
But you'd imagine they're only going to be domestic groups.
Yes.
And we don't know whether domestic companies are really going to be sending that size of group, given the financial situation.
Absolutely.
In the foreseeable future.
Big budget, especially if you were thinking of sending them to one of these fancy restaurants.
Fancy
resorts.
Yeah. So I guess from here, Hannah, we're looking at, for the foreseeable future, it's going to be domestic travel.
Yes.
So how are domestic travelers going to travel? What are they looking for? Well, it does look at the moment as though its self-drive is very important.
Yeah.
One of the issues in terms of flying is the number of cancellations. Now, I think there's two reasons for that. One is low demand from passengers to take the flights. You know, look at the airport boards and there's loads of cancelled flights.
Yeah.
And the other one is the actual flight prices, you know, because airlines don't really know how many people are going to be boarding, how often they can run these flights.
Yeah.
Flight prices at the moment tend to be quite high. So, for example, We flew up to Penang this week, and the flight price was more than it normally was pre-COVID. But then you get there and you stay in the hotel, and the hotel was discounted at probably about 60% of the normal rate. So, you know, you balance that out, and it does work. But for a lot of travelers, you know, the off-putting factor is the airfare.
Yeah.
And also the safety element. So, yes. You know, we're seeing, if you look on Instagram at the moment, from KL, you know, a lot of the choices that people are taking for weekend trips or day breaks are places that are drivable from the city. So Pangkor Island, there's the Sky Mirror, you know, in Kuala Selangor Beach, where the waves are, there are no waves. It's a flat sea. So you can take these curated sort of mirror pictures. And there's another place called Sekin Chan. Have you seen that?
Just like rice. Is it rice paddy?
So it's a rice paddy. Mm. And there's a famous photographer has set up this sort of curated, but it's a mini restaurant where he creates your Malaysia breakfast for you. He's made it very, very colorful, the table settings and everything.
Oh, nice.
And then people can take their own curated pictures. And that's become very popular in the last week or so. And the interesting thing about that, Hannah, as we said last week, is that, you know, how when domestic travelers travel, they sometimes go to places that international travelers don't tend to.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're coming next year and you're looking at some of the trends of where to go in Malaysia off the beaten track, you know, follow on Instagram what local travelers are doing.
Yes.
Because they will be drivable destinations from the big urban centres.
They will, yeah, you're right. It will definitely help inbound travel, I think you've said before.
One of the issues when international travel comes back again is where will it come from? You know, this year in Visit Malaysia, heavy priority was placed on China and India. Two very, very big markets. As you said in the stats there, Hannah, Singapore leads the way by a considerable number. Indonesia is very, very important as well.
Yeah.
But perhaps there are other ASEAN countries, maybe Australia, New Zealand, they might look at to
yeah, build, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, they've been talking, haven't they, that they're in talks with Australia, New Zealand, Brunei, Singapore. Who are some of the other countries?
Vietnam, I think.
Vietnam, maybe Thailand.
Thailand, yeah.
Australia, like we already said, I think that's out. You know, I think however much all the Southeast Asian countries want to be in a travel bubble with Australia, it doesn't sound like Australia wants to be in a travel bubble with them.
Not in the near term.
Not in the near term. Indonesia, I know, you know, both countries have been saying, we're going to work together, we're going to open the travel bubble. But the two countries are in such different states with COVID right now, aren't they? You know, I think Indonesia is still seeing cases really rising. They're still having new highs of case numbers.
Yeah.
Malaysia is not going to want to open up to Indonesia anytime soon.
Yeah.
So I think that really leaves Singapore, and I think Singapore we'll see come in the next few weeks. I really think so, because we said that they're so interconnected. There's so much trade. There's so many reasons to open them up. So definitely Singapore.
Middle East?
Well, maybe. You know, Emirates is flying back again. Dubai is open, isn't it, for tourists?
Qatar is flying again.
Yeah.
And actually, if you looked at the stats from last year, although the actual volume of tourist visitors to Malaysia were from the local countries, in terms of actual spend, average spend, the highest figures were from the Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, absolutely. They're really big spenders when they come over here. And not only for tourism, but for retail as well.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in Bukit Bintang, which is the center of KL, and you're in one of the fancy malls, you see a lot of Middle Eastern travelers there. So I'm sure that those shops are hurting right now.
Yeah. What about extending into Central Asia? Do we see those markets?
Central Asia.
Russia, perhaps?
Russia. I mean, you never know. There is this relationship that Malaysia and Russia have, but I'm not sure. I think
Russians have tended to favor Vietnam or Thailand in previous years.
Exactly. So let's see. I think Europe is unlikely still. And I think that's, I mean, there are such deep links between Malaysia and the UK, really deep links. But the UK, again, would Malaysia want to open up there? It's a kind of an uncertain situation in terms of COVID, isn't it?
I think the other uncertainty about that is the flight situation. So we don't yet know what's going to happen with British Airways, but they've said that they're going to slim down their fleet. Will they be cutting routes like Malaysia? No, will Malaysia Airlines do the same? Will it still fly as frequently as it did to the UK?
Yeah.
In that way, the only connectivity is going to be through the Middle East.
And are people going to want to transit?
And are people going to want to transit?
So, to conclude, we're not really sure, but likely ASEAN.
We're not really sure. But the other angle here, Hannah, is in terms of how Malaysia markets this country.
Yeah.
Because we've discussed this before, it hasn't really changed that promotional focus for a long, long time. You know, Malaysia Truly Asia, it's a great campaign. It has always been a great campaign, but it hasn't really changed that. Now, I attended the World Tour, the UNWTO had its World Urban Tourism Summit here in Kuala Lumpur in 2017. And the then Secretary General of the UNWTO, Taleb Rifai, gave a very good speech, actually. And he, obviously, he was very favourable towards his host. And he said that he'd loved the campaign Malaysia Truly Asia, but he suggested that they changed it to Malaysia the Best of Asia to just sort of give it a bit of an upgrade. Obviously, that was never taken note of. I don't know if they trademarked it. But I thought it was quite an interesting angle, basically to twist what you've already got, but just to give it a slightly different...
Yeah,
impetus.
I mean, Malaysia Truly Asia is almost, it's like it's more fun in the Philippines. It's one of these taglines that people...
Endures.
Yeah, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
But it's more of a trope now, isn't it?
It is, and the imagery that goes with it, obviously the beautiful nature, particularly in Sarawak and Sabah.
Yeah.
You know, the cultural traditions in northern Malaysia, those tend to focus. Then you have the landmarks like the Petronas Towers, whatever. You just wonder whether tourism itself, I mean, was changing anyway, the way that people want to be put themselves into the experience. So you need more visitors in those imagery, you know, not just being shown what a country can do, but how you can actually impact or influence your own travel in that country. Wonder whether that was perhaps missing before COVID and probably is going to be even more important afterwards. People are going to want to be more customized, more tailored. They're going to want themselves in the picture. Maybe it has to look slightly differently in the way that it promotes the country.
I think so. I mean, I was listening to a webinar again the other week, and this was from somebody who has been involved, I think, with Tourism Malaysia at the moment, trying to develop their new roadmap. And he'd said that the strategy for Malaysian tourism hasn't changed since 1992, which is...
That is astonishing. But we see that. I mean, we do see that. You can see that. And the... I mean, the point about that is it did have a strong USP back in 1992.
Yes.
You know, but if you look at the way that kind of particularly Vietnam in our region, you know, we always hold Vietnam's tourism marketing up as quite a high standard, and they seem to be evolving quite fast.
Yeah.
And the level of competition in this region to attract tourists and Malaysia's growth numbers haven't really kicked on in the past years. There needs to be a reboot of the way the country is marketed. Okay. Maybe this is the great time to do that. Maybe this gives an opportunity to actually be a bit bolder with the marketing and rethink. Because there is this issue that how do you market both the peninsula and East Malaysia? Because they have very, very different appeals. And East Malaysia particularly is very, very strong with the Northeast Asia travel market. You know, Chinese, Koreans, Japanese love that natural element, you know, the jungle, the wildlife. Yes. The seafood, the coastlines there, whereas the peninsula is very, very different. But how you manage that is quite difficult. Managing two geographies in tourism marketing is pretty difficult.
So, Gary, that brings us almost to the end of this Malaysia special edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, it does indeed. So just before we wrap up, Hannah, are you optimistic about the future of travel in this country? It's a long road to recovery, isn't it?
It's a long road to recovery. I think it will happen. I think domestic travel will start picking up in the next couple of weeks, but just my concern is whether, as we've said a couple of episodes before, whether it's just going to be a one-off thing. People are going to suddenly book that holiday and then not book anything for a few more months rather than that consistent going on holiday. So I think the government does need to just think about how to incentivize and support the industry to kind of promote that continuous domestic tourism.
Yeah, and I think consumers need clarity as well. I think there is a little bit of a case of watching and waiting. You know, if there is an opportunity that you could travel to Thailand in the next 3 or 4 months, would you prioritize that rather than spending your money on a domestic trip? If you know that you can't do that, would you then actually book your domestic trip? Would you book both? You know, there's a real lack of transparency about what's actually going to happen. And you know, in a market where people love to travel, they love value for their travel.
Yeah.
I think it's understandable that they're watching and waiting. So we hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, we'd love to read your comments and your feedback on anything that we've said today or anything that we've missed out. So please send us a note by email at hello@seasiatravelshow.com or via our Facebook page at The SEA Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
And look out for our daily travel and tourism insights, opinions and podcast news on our LinkedIn page, The Southeast Asia Travel Show. And on our Instagram at SEA Travel Show. And of course, you can catch up with us on all of our previous episodes on the website, the scasiatravelshow.com or Spotify. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, and don't forget our Friday mini briefing newsletter, which this week features Brunei. Ooh. You can sign up for free on our LinkedIn page. And before we go, a heads up for next week's show, Hannah, which marks our 25th anniversary.
Yay.
It's our 25th podcast. So we have something special planned for that, so please stay tuned.
Do. And that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to plan a Malaysian island vacation. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.